buses or rail? In Miami-Dade, that argument comes back for an important vote later this month. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Transportation Planning Organization is gathering again at the end of this month for a planned vote. Will there be more buses or rail? The mayor, Carlos Jimenez, is pushing hard for the buses, claiming it's a better investment. We'll hear the mayor's case for the buses. Plus, the Pinellas County Sheriff is under attack for not arresting a man who was caught on video shooting and killing another man. The sheriff says he can't because of the Stand Your Ground law. We'll dig into the recent changes to the law and Florida's affinity for it. And Vizcaya Museum is hosting a parade this weekend that is an immersive experience.
The entire journey goes from land to sea. It essentially traces James Deering's own journey.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Miami-Dade County leaders have an important decision to make at the end of this month. It's a decision that will shape the way Miamians move around. It's a vote by the Transportation Planning Organization. They're going to decide if the county should go forward with plans for more rail or a new bus rapid transit system. Mayor Carlos Jimenez, once a supporter of rail, believes the new bus system is a better option, a cheaper option, and at least the best one for the foreseeable future. The TPO will come back again August 28th for this vote. We're joined now by Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez. And if you have a question about the vote, maybe about how this bus system would work, or if you're convinced that we should have more rail, we'd like to hear your thoughts. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can also find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Mayor Jimenez, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So you're trying to convince people that rail's not the answer, at least not right now, and that it would be beneficial for Miami to invest in this bus rapid transit. When did you decide it was a good time to move to that?
Well, the bus rapid transit option actually was the preferred local recommended option back in 2007. So this is not something that's brand new. So bus rapid transit has been around for a long time.
But has the debate basically gone to it's either this or that?
No, but you know, and that's the problem. And so, in order for us to put rail at grade, I'm not even talking Metro Rail, down all the way down to Florida City, it's well over $1 billion. And the cost of maintaining and operating that rail system is two times to three times the cost of bus rapid transit. The problem with bus rapid transit is the word bus. And people have this connotation of what a bus is, and therefore people may think that we're putting lipstick on a bus, okay, and that's what we're calling that bus rapid transit, and therefore that's it, and that's not it at all. And some people are actually misleading.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Describe for us what this is then.
All right. Bus rapid.
How would it work?
Okay. Bus rapid transit that we want to create is this. You build stations like a rail. You go in and you prepay boarding like rail. You're on a platform like rail. When the vehicle comes, it opens up with the doors on the side like rail. People get out, people get in. Inside, it's going to look very much like a train. And then when it comes to intersections, the guard gates go down and you actually have preemption with these vehicles just like rail. The only difference is that you don't have steel tracks and you don't have steel wheels. It's much more flexible. It'll get you there just as quickly as a train, and it'll get you there just as comfortably as a train. The only thing is, it's not a train. It's a bus or a rubber-wheeled vehicle.
It's as fast as the train?
It's as fast as the train.
Doesn't hold as many people as the train, though.
It doesn't, but then what happens is you end up with more frequency in order to have the capacity. And also remember that the problem with South Dade, I mean, it's not a problem, that's like the way they like it, is they don't have the density that you have in other parts of the county. So, people say, well, hey, you're going away from rail. No, I would love to activate commuter rail on the Northeast Corridor. The rail's already there. Brightline's already operating passenger rail. It would make sense for us because we don't have to invest so much money in the infrastructure to actually activate that with rail. So it's not that I don't like rail, it's that every different corridor may have a different modality, and the modality is, that means what kind of technology you're going to use to get people from point A to point B. They're not all the same. It's not all, it doesn't have to all be the same. It won't all be bus rapid transit. It won't all be rail. It'll be a combination of a bunch of different things.
In a recent op-ed piece in the Miami Herald, you talked about this bus rapid transit system. Until there is sufficient ridership to justify the cost of construction of rail, what does that sufficient ridership look like to you?
Probably 35 to 40,000 boardings a day would be sufficient to begin the conversation. Now, look, in the original, you know, I've read some documents back in 2002 when they passed the half cent. There was a memo, internal memo, that was written concerning when certain things were supposed to happen. Now, mind you, at the end of the day, there really wasn't sufficient money to do Metro Rail, extensions of Metro Rail to eight different places, because Metro Rail costs $200 to $250 million a mile just for construction. And it's about three times more expensive than anything else. So there really wasn't this the money available. But let's for the sake of argument, the South Dade extension of the Metro Rail wasn't even supposed to begin until 2028. So people are not going to wait till 2028. The money won't be there for an extension of Metro Rail to South Dade in 2028. We need to do things now, things that we can afford now, give people options now. If, in fact, we put rail all the way down to South Dade, as some people want, they will be taking and gobbling up something like 73% of all the money that's available for transit in the next 40 years. That, to me, is irresponsible. As mayor of Miami-Dade County, I can't just watch out for one segment of our community. I got to watch out for all of it. If we do bus rapid transit, it takes 12%. Of the money that will be available for the next 30, 40 years. And so that's a much more responsible way to do things. It's a much quicker way to get rapid transit down to South Dade. If you do rail, you're going to have to wait at least 10 years in order for it to implement, because you're gonna have to go for federal funding. You're going to have to get state funding. And when you go to federal funding, I don't know what the bureaucracy is in this radio station, but man, you got to go to the federal government to see the bureaucracy. You got to get rated not only once, probably two or three times. Then money has to be appropriated, or a recommendation has to be given. Then money has to be appropriated. You're not going to see this for another 10 years.
All right. Again, talking with Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez, and we're talking about this upcoming vote here at the end of the month. And in this discussion, what is the right choice as we move forward in trying to deal with the transit system here in the county? What is the smarter choice? Is it this bus rapid transit system? We're talking about going south, or is it more rail? And again, going back, we go back to the 2002 when there was that promise of rail. Is that the answer? Some people don't want rail. Other people are open to other options. But what is the right choice? Let's go to the phones real quickly. I want to start with Monica in Coral Gables. Monica, welcome to the program. Monica, are you there? We may have a little issue with the connection. Monica, are you there?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, Monica.
We can hear. I don't hear you.
Okay, we can hear you. All right, we're going to try to fix the phones. Monica, stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. We're going to try to set that up. We're going to get it going. I wanted to come back to, real quickly, is going all the way back to, this goes back to 2002, mm-hmm. when there was that half-cent tax, to pay for increased transit, and part of that was rail. You've heard the argument. People said, wait a second, we voted for this. We want this. What happened to the money, and why are we still having this debate 15 plus years later?
Well, because the money was never sufficient to do what the people thought it was going to do. I wasn't there in 2002. I didn't make any promises. I can just tell you what we have right now, what's available right now, and what we can do right now in order to alleviate traffic problems. Even the extension of rail down into South Dade, it's not a Metro Rail. It's at grade. It's different than what was said that was going to happen in 2028. And if we did a Metro Rail to South Dade, probably gobbles up 100% of all the money that's available for the next 20, 30 years. And so that's, to me, is not responsible. There's not the ridership. There isn't the density to do this. And so people say, well, you promised it. You need to do that. Well, then, yeah, but, Metro Rail was promised all the way to the east. Metro Rail promised to the north. Metro Rail was promised to Miami Beach. So is this a question of somebody rolling the dice and say, okay, one group of folks are going to get the Metro Rail and then nobody else? And by the way, one final thing. we're on the cusp of a revolution in transportation. We really are. And so it would almost be irresponsible to invest that much money on one system.
You're talking about we have ridership programs, but also, I mean, we're still kind of a ways off, though, from driverless cars. I mean, is that what you're talking
about? No,
there's
more than that. I mean, there's okay. a bunch of different technologies that are coming. And then there's also, you know, if you really think about Uber, Lyft, yes, autonomous vehicles, but not for individuals, but the autonomous vehicles of mass transit is actually coming a lot faster than people think, too. And there's other bunch of different technologies.
What about we come back to ridership, though,
sure.
because ridership is down
right.
for rail
right.
and for Metro Mover and for buses. So is there
yep.
a concern you're going to build a bus system, but maybe, one, they're going to be angry because they didn't want that, and two, ridership's down anyway?
Well, ridership is down because I think people have more options. I think Uber and Lyft have a great deal to do with that. I think people, look, the only, when mass transit will be a hit when it takes you from everywhere to everywhere, even if we built, okay, once we built the six different corridors, it still doesn't take you from everywhere to everywhere. It only gives people other options. And so what we need to do is focus on all of the options and give people as many of the options that we can afford as possible, options that actually will decrease their time. Not for 100% of the people, because that'll never happen, all right? But for a certain percentage that then will alleviate the traffic that's congesting our roads.
All right, let me go back to the phones. I think we got this sorted out. I'm going to go back to Monica in Coral Gables. Monica, you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Thank you for your patience. Go ahead, Monica.
Hi, Mayor Jimenez. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I actually am for the bus system, especially if it can be an electric vehicle, because of the fact that that would help with energy efficiency, which saves us, the taxpayers, money in terms of the most cost-effective type of vehicle. Also, I've ridden bus systems like this in very dense populated cities in Europe, and it works. So that would even help with the Miami traffic situation.
Monica, thank you so much. By the way, you said you've ridden this in other cities. Can you tell us real quickly, like where?
Yes, absolutely. In Amsterdam, in Belgium. I've ridden in dense European cities that are historic, a lot more dense than here. And it's absolutely a welcomed part of the on-street available transit.
Monica, thank you so much for the call again. Thank you for your patience. Are these buses on this bus rapid transit system, are they going to be electric?
Yeah, that's what we want to do. We want to put them. We want to make them electric. That means they'll be much quieter than trains, because you know when you know Metrorail, when they stop, the squealing and all that, and then the steel on steel is very very noisy. These vehicles are rubber tires. They'll be electric. They'll have a side opening, prepaid admission. Again, it does just about everything that a train does, except it's not a train.
And is it going to be on existing roads? Do we have to build extra roads for it?
No, not in the Southgate Busway. The busway is already there. All right. But the problem is, people say, "Okay, you already have a busway. We don't. It's not very efficient." Bus rapid transit is not what we have on the Southgate Busway, and people are saying, "Well, that's bus rapid transit." It's not. It's not bus rapid transit. Bus rapid transit also has limited number of stops, like a station, like the rail stations. You know, you don't a train doesn't stop every 200 feet like a bus does on the street right now, which, by the way, we have to fix that too. All right. A train stops, let's say, every mile. The same thing will happen with BRT. Your stations will be, and by the way, if we do this, the investment that we make in BRT is going to be investment and money that we don't throw out the window once we convert to rail, because the same arm gates that will give you a preference, or actually priority, all right, for BRT is the same arm gates that you get when a train is coming down. The stations, we just have to make them a little longer, but the footprint stays the same. Make them a little longer because the trains are a little bit longer. We raise the platform for the train height, and so you don't lose that investment either. So what we really want to do is, look, there is some money available. It's called small starts for projects that are $300 million or less. There is a good chance to get about $100 million from the federal government, $100 million from the state, and then $100 million from us, and then we can get this system up and running in the next 2 to 3 years.
You know, there's
I would say, look, 3 to 4 years, because normally when somebody says 2 to 3, okay, it would be 3 to 4, okay?
You know there's pushback, and you've been hearing it for a while now. One of those folks is State Representative Keone McGee. He was on the program this week, and he started by saying this about the promise of rail.
The county approached the people in Miami-Dade County and said this: if you decide to voluntarily tax yourself at a half cent, we would deliver to you, in the north, the south, we would deliver to you rail. We would connect this entire county. We would make this. We would make the roads better. We would produce a better system, a coordinated system. I can honestly tell you, since 2002, we've seen at least, we've gone through at least three presidents, three mayors, probably countless governors, and yet they have only delivered 3 miles of the 88 miles that they promised.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's called lack of political courage.
All right. You weren't here for that original vote, obviously.
Right.
A lot of people weren't, but at the same time, I mean, this is the argument that you're hearing. It's like, we were promised. And so how do you, I mean, what do you answer
to him?
Well,
I think the optimum thing he said at the end was lack of political courage, and that is he's willing to raise taxes in order to do it.
He did say later in the program that he would not do that.
Well, then he can't do what he said he's going to do. He can't make that promise. The problem is that people are still promising stuff that you can't deliver because the money's not there.
What about a private-public situation?
You know, some people, here's the other thing that frustrates me. Do you really think that a private company is going to come in here, invest billions of dollars, and then not expect to get their money back and make a profit?
He says he's been talking with different companies that they could come in, build this quickly, mm-hmm. and it would be a good opportunity.
Sure, and then you'd have to pay it back. Do you really think, I'm going to ask you now a question.
Oh, well, I'm not the one to ask.
Just as an individual, okay. just think about common sense. And here's the misconception that somehow public-private partnerships, that somehow we don't have to pay because it's a private company coming in. That is ludicrous, because a private company is going to want a return on investment.
Well, sure. No, of course. I understand what you're saying. But, I mean, you look at SunPass. We talked about SunPass on that. I mean, it is, you know, you have a private company that's processing. This is, you know, on these roads. But that was his argument. He says that you could bring in a private company to help in that and have a private-public partnership, and that they could build this rail, and they could do it cheaper, and they could do it faster.
They may be able to do it. If you do have a public-private partnership, the way that they do it cheaper is by the operation and maintenance of it, which means that Miami-Dade Transit would no longer operate that particular side, which I have no problem with, by the way. All right, but there's no way that you can keep the promise of rail to everywhere. And he only said south and north.
Right now,
he said south and north. Well, what happens to east and west? What happened to all the people out in West Kendall? What happened to all the people in Miami Beach? What happened to all the people in the northeast section of Miami-Dade County? He conveniently leaves those out. Hey, but I can't and I won't, because I'm the mayor of Miami-Dade County. He has his constituency down south. He'd love to see rail go down south. He even says north, all right? But he doesn't talk about the rest of Miami-Dade County, and that's not something that I'm willing to abandon. Oh. So we have to look at each corridor in its own right and develop the strategy to develop the right mass transit solution for that corridor. Metrorail, the extension of Metrorail at grade, is highly, highly expensive. It would gobble up all the money, and then what do you do for the rest of the county?
Let's go back to that July 19th meeting. What happened? Because they pushed the vote off to later this month, which is after the primaries, by the way.
I think the people that thought that the vote wasn't going their way deferred the action. And if you look at who moved it and seconded it, it was the people that wanted rail down to Florida City.
So what do you think is going to be different at the end of this month when they come back to it?
I'm not sure what's going to be. You know what's going to be different is that I'm going to go out and explain to people what BRT really is all about, and that BRT is not what people are telling you it is, and then people are making promises to you that they cannot keep. And this mayor, this man right here in front of you, doesn't make promises that he can't keep. I didn't make that promise in 2002. What I'm trying to do is make sure that we have the right solution for the right corridor and give people options, all kinds of options. If you recall, I'm the guy that brought Uber and Lyft here. I had to fight for that. People were saying, no, you shouldn't do this. Oh, my God, da, da, da. And I said, no, it's the right thing to do. This is the right thing to do. I fight for what I believe is right, not for just one segment of the community, but the entire community. And I will continue to fight, and I will continue to come on the radio and TV. And I also want people to be educated what BRT is. And like I said, The bad word in BRT is bus, and when everybody thinks of a bus, they have this connotation of what a bus is. Yeah, I understand that, but BRT is not what you believe it is. BRT is like a rail, except it's on rubber tires.
Let me take another call here real quick. Ivana is in Cooper City. Ivana, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. I've heard the mayor talking about different options, but all I'm hearing is buses and Uber, which means that we're going to have more pollution and we're going to have more tires on the road. So, and also the suburbs are not even mentioned, not even once. So are the buses going to have a special route that where the other cars are not going to use? That would make sense.
Yes.
But they will. Okay. And how about the suburbs? Like, are they going to come to the suburbs?
Well, that's
also, how about pollution?
No, ma'am, that's why we wanted to use electric buses. And so right now we are converting 300 of our buses from diesel to that are running on diesel to CNG, compressed natural gas. But then we're also have an RFP on the street for electric buses. We want to convert our fleet to electric buses so they're non-polluting. Then if you talk about the suburbs, then one of the things we're doing on the 836 expansion is actually running a BRT system on the 836. Again, looking initially with diesel-powered buses, but eventually with rubber-tired vehicles that are electric in nature. And so, yeah, and so, it's different types of options, different places. And by the way, I'm a proponent of initiating rail right now on the Northeast Corridor. There are probably 500,000 to 1 million people living within a mile of that corridor. The density is there. People are ready to go. The tracks are already laid down and trains are already going right now. So that's the next thing that that I'll be focusing in on is actually activating that for commuter rail.
Ivana,
okay, thank you.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Let's finish up with this, Mayor Jimenez. Again, you have just a few more weeks left before, again, the TPO comes back to talk about this, but I mean, is it you're just going around neighborhood to neighborhood? Look, this is what this bus rapid transit system is going to be. Do you think you have the votes? Do you think that
I think I had the votes on at the meeting. I'm not sure what will happen at the next meeting. Look, again, when you look at in politics, the people who defer an item are the ones that don't think they have the votes. The people who deferred that item the other day were the people that wanted the extension of Metro Rail down to Florida City. And I wish that we had the money to do that. Actually, I wish we had the density to do that, because twice now consultants have come in and said the best option for South Dade at this time, back in 2007 and now, is bus rapid transit, a bus rapid transit system. And that's what I think we ought to do. Once they get the ridership up, then you can start looking at putting some other option in there, whether it be rail or whatever technology is available in the future.
It's a meeting we're going to keep our eyes on, and you're always welcome back. Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. And you can always still share your thoughts. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you think. All right. Still to come, Florida Stand Your Ground Law back in the spotlight. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, yesterday, the Florida State Attorney's Office received the case of Marquise McLaughlin. He was the unarmed black man shot and killed in front of a convenience store in Clearwater by Michael Dreschke. Dreschke had a concealed weapons permit and hasn't been arrested because he claimed the shooting was in self-defense under Florida's Stand Your Ground law. The event has sparked controversy nationwide about how Stand Your Ground is used and interpreted. Stemming from the Trayvon Martin case in 2012, Florida has been a center point for the Stand Your Ground debate and has come up again in recent years with the shooting death of Corey Jones in Palm Beach Gardens. Caroline Light is the director of Women, Gender, and Sex Studies at Harvard University and the author of a new book titled Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. She's been following the Clearwater story closely, and she joins us from the studios of WVTF in Roanoke, Virginia. Caroline Light, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this. What makes this case, the one in Clearwater, unique is the presence of surveillance video. From what you've seen of the footage, what do we know about how this event transpired? Is it clear?
Well, it depends on who you ask. And this is where I think ideas of reasonable self-defense or perception of threat are actually very subjective. If you look at the full video footage, starting from where Dreschka approaches Brittany Jacobs aggressively in her car where she's sitting with her two small children, it does appear that he is aggressively addressing himself to her when McLaughlin comes out of the store and pushes him away from the car. However, for many people looking at this video, they see specifically Marquise McLaughlin aggressively, or as Sheriff Gualtieri said, violently shoving Dreschka out of the way, thereby justifying Dreschka's perception of threat and his pulling out his handgun and shooting McLaughlin dead.
And there's a moment there where, as Dreschka is taking out his gun, McLaughlin mm-hmm. looks like he's stepping back. And then there's a shooting.
Absolutely. I mean, he's clearly pushed him out of the way to get him away from his family, protecting his family, his right to stand his ground. And he steps back, clearly not following up with further attack against Dreschka. And it's in that moment that Dreschka pulls out the gun and, without hesitating, shoots him in the chest. So this is what's mystifying to me is, A, that it's clear Dreschka is the one who initiates the confrontation by approaching Ms. Jacobs in her car aggressively. And then he had the choice to either end the confrontation after being pushed to the ground, or pulling out his gun and holding it, brandishing it, but not shooting it. And instead of choosing that, he chose to follow through with lethal violence, which was completely unnecessary.
As you know, Florida law now requires the burden of proof in stand your ground cases to be on the prosecution. What could the prosecution potentially use in this video to make the argument that Dreschka's life wasn't endangered?
Well, I would focus first on, you know, the visual evidence that McLaughlin isn't following up. After he pushes Dreschka down, he steps away. He's clearly just trying to protect his own family. I would focus on that alongside the fact that the entire confrontation is initiated by Dreschka. He's the one who started this confrontation. If he had kept to himself, if he had, called someone else, or, you know, asked a police officer to write a ticket for the illegal parking infraction, it was on him to instigate this. And I would say the prosecution would probably focus on those instances and, of course, the visual evidence that McLaughlin was not trying to attack him further after Dreschka hit the ground.
Let's get some background on the foundation of Stand Your Ground. This is all linked to the Castle Doctrine, right?
Right. Yes, the Castle Doctrine, rooted in English common law before we even had a United States. This is the idea that a man's home is his castle, and if someone attacks you in your own home, you needn't try to get away before using lethal violence against a threat. However, outside of the castle, you are expected to try to get away, to try to retreat before using lethal self-defense if you perceived a threat. So what Stand Your Ground laws do is that they expand the parameters of the castle so that wherever you may legally be, you're allowed to use deadly violence if you perceive yourself under threat. However, as we've seen multiple times, this law and these exemptions apply only to specific people and leave other people out in the cold.
There's been several Stand Your Ground cases in Florida over the past several years that have really shaped our thinking in the debate. Of course, the most famous was the George Zimmerman shooting of Trayvon Martin. FYI, there is a new docuseries on the Trayvon Martin case out now. It's premiered this week. But that technically wasn't even a Stand Your Ground case, though, was it?
Well, okay, so technically it wasn't. However, Stand Your Ground influences the way people behave and the way they perceive a reasonable threat. So in that courtroom, that jury had an instruction to consider whether George Zimmerman was reasonable in his perception of Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old, as a lethal threat to him. And because they did, because really the only person, the only witness left standing after the confrontation was George Zimmerman, his testimony was allowed to prevail in that case. So stand your ground laws do script the way our larger society understands a reasonable threat. And in that moment, I don't think you can necessarily separate out the instructions around reasonable cause for self-defense. Yeah. So many people say it wasn't technically a stand your ground case, but I think that case would not have turned out the way it did without stand your ground laws.
Have we seen an increase in the use of stand your ground as a method for avoiding prosecution since the Zimmerman trial?
So I think so. What I do know is there's some research that shows that we've seen an uptick in homicide in the state of Florida and in other states where stand your ground laws have been instituted. We've seen a bunch of cases. We've seen some cases in Florida now where police officers have invoked stand your ground immunity to avoid criminal prosecution when they shoot and kill civilians.
You're talking about the Corey Jones case here in Palm Beach Gardens.
Right. And Jermaine McBean. So these are, you know, both African-American men in their 30s, I believe, both of them, in cases where police can allege that they were in fear for their life when they shoot and kill a civilian. And so those cases are, I believe, both ongoing. I believe that one of them is about to make its way to court, the one for Corey Jones. However, police officers are trying to invoke stand your ground immunity to avoid criminal prosecution. So at least in Corey Jones's case, his killer is going to be going to court, which is a good thing, but he can still claim that he was reasonably in fear for his life. And as we know, law enforcement has pretty high success rate in claiming that they were reasonably in fear for their life when they kill civilians.
I'm speaking with Dr. Caroline Light. She's the director of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Program at Harvard University and the author of a new book, Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. We're discussing the recent shooting death in Clearwater, Florida of Marquise McLaughlin by Michael Dreschke, who's arguing his actions were covered under Florida's Stand Your Ground law. You talk about Corey Jones. I did also want to mention that, yes, the latest argument from the defense team is that the officer is claiming, Newman Raja is claiming, that he believed he had seen a red pointer, a laser pointer, as in one of those mm-hmm. that you might have on a gun, and that perhaps the light from a red light, street light, may have reflected off a weapon. But we talk about a couple of cases. I want to ask about Corey Jones, but I wanted to come back to this other one, another Stand Your Ground case here in Florida that illustrates some trends that we've seen in how the law works. First, tell us about Marissa Alexander and her case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that as a critical case for helping expose the blind spots of Stand Your Ground, or maybe it's more accurate to say the ways in which not everybody is really allowed to stand their ground. And this was prior to Trayvon Martin's killing a couple years. Marissa Alexander was trying to defend herself from her estranged husband. She was trying to retrieve her belongings from the house they had shared after giving birth prematurely to the couple's daughter. And she got in the house and she's trying to retrieve her belongings. And her husband came home and obstructed her from leaving and threatened her life. She shot a warning shot. Did not kill anybody, shot a warning shot, and was arrested and charged and imprisoned. And her claims of stand your ground, her claims that she was in reasonable fear from a man who had a documented history of abuse against her. She had protective orders against him and a long history of abuse. Did not hold up in court, in part because the prosecution claimed that she was not in fear, but rather that she was angry and that the shots she fired were retributive and not out of fear. And I think it's important to keep in mind that in this case, Marissa Alexander is an African-American woman. But I would also say that for many women, it's very difficult to claim stand your ground against an intimate partner. And in this case, she didn't even kill anyone. She shot a warning shot and she ended up going to prison.
The stand your ground law, I mean, it fundamentally, as you said, it comes down to the perception of your life being threatened. But I mean, what are some of the systemic issues of something that is fundamentally subjective being used to determine mm-hmm. whether lethal force is justified?
Mm. Well, I mean, the way I like to say it is that perceptions of threat are in the eye of the beholder. And when you come from a larger society that is structured by a lot of very unacknowledged or under-acknowledged biases, whether we're talking about white supremacy, misogyny, homophobia, all of these different biases, it's very hard to have a truly objective standard by which we determine if a person's claim of self-defense is truly reasonable. So for me, I think we need to consider the multiple ways in which reasonableness gets constructed as something subjective. We need to consider that, for instance, in our society, people are likely to perceive brown and black men as criminals and as threats, even when they're unarmed, even when they're doing nothing wrong. We're also more likely to judge the victims of domestic violence as being somehow responsible for their victimhood. So
let me start with this one. I'm wondering, are there studies that help us understand the psychology behind when humans actually fear for their lives?
Oh, sure. There's a recent one that came out from the American Psychological Association, I believe, March last year, co-authored by a group of psychologists who did a study to determine how people, and by people I mean their subjects were of multiple different race backgrounds, how they perceive black masculinity. And the very clear results were that people tend to perceive black men as larger and often more threatening than the same size white men. So there's empirical proof out there that shows that we have these biases that we carry around with us. And we carry those biases into the courtroom. We carry those biases out into the street. And when we're trying to defend ourselves from a perceived threat, or when we're trying to adjudicate a claim of self-defense in a courtroom, those biases are going to inhibit the truly objective adjudication of justice.
Do you think, because this shooting in Clearwater, Drejka is a white man. He shot a black man. If it was reversed, right, it would be different.
Absolutely. I mean, let's try to imagine it for a moment. If there's a young white mother sitting in her car with her two babies in the back seat, and an armed black man approaches her car and yells at her for being illegally parked, and her white boyfriend comes out of the store and pushes that man out of the way, and what if he ends up getting shot? I absolutely think we would expect to see an arrest of a black shooter in that case. So what I do see is a lot of denial that the racial implications or optics of this case are relevant from a lot of folks, predominantly from white folks.
The state attorney's office has Michael Drejka's case, though he's currently not under arrest. Do we know what information the attorney and the sheriff's office would be provided or need in order to bring him in?
Mm. I heard that it's a voluminous case right now. I mean, I'm not sure. I imagine that they're going to be poring over the visual evidence. I'm hoping they are going to interview Ms. Jacobs, among other witnesses of what happened. I'm actually somewhat hopeful that they will decide that Drejka should be taken into custody upon further reflection. They have quite a lot of material to consider. And I above all hope that they're going to look very carefully at the visual evidence, but look at the early part of the relevant piece before just looking at the place where McLaughlin shoved Drejka.
And there's a lot of pressure on the sheriff to arrest him. Do you think, do you think this is going to play out?
Yes.
This law is playing out in, law enforcement afraid to arrest anybody because, lawsuits could come.
Exactly. And that's essentially what Sheriff Gualtieri said. He said, my hands are tied. I can't make an arrest in this case without probable cause. Law enforcement, understand your ground, becomes liable if they arrest somebody who turns out to have been justifiable in their claims of self-defense. So it really does. It essentially, first, it makes law enforcement liable. Secondly, it also forces law enforcement to decide right there in the moment what to do.
I have to stop you there only because of time.
Okay.
Dr. Carolyn Light, director of the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Program at Harvard University. Her new book is Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. Dr. Light, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, she joined us from the studios of WVTF in Roanoke, Virginia. All right, still to come, a unique parade at Vizcaya Museum where everyone takes part. No observers. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, this is our Friday, so we're going to have a little fun. I know it's Thursday. Twinkling and illuminated lanterns, puppets, and more will take over the Vizcaya Museum Gardens on Saturday in commemoration of the museum's founder, James Deering. The New York-based processional arts workshop returns for the third time to Vizcaya for a performance called Float. This year's theatrical performance centers around Deering's journey to Miami and Vizcaya's relationship to the sea. To talk about the performance and the museum's history is Alex Kahn, the co-founder and co-director of Processional Arts Workshops. He joined us in studio, and I started off by asking him what people should expect to see and experience.
So if you're an audience member, you're going to show up, and the way that it's been described is a participatory parade. So what that means is that when we think of parades, we think of people standing behind barricades and waving to big floats going by, and it's a very divided kind of thing. What we try to do is integrate people into the performance. So the first thing that will happen is that we have various illuminated elements, small lanterns, also some handmade instruments, and those things will be dispersed through the crowd as they arrive so that everybody will get to be part of the visual landscape that we're trying to create. So right off the bat, nobody is a passive bystander. So we'll line ourselves up in the village at Vizcaya, the old, what had been the working farm part of the estate. And then when we set off, there will be sort of an ambient soundscape that people will hear, and we'll start moving through the village. And as we meander through the village, more and more illuminated visual elements will appear. There's a sort of playfulness to it. And of course, all of our performers are volunteers, so everybody has a different way of kind of finessing their individual performance in this. But little by little, more and more lanterns that were handmade in workshops by various people according to the history of the estate, they will be appearing from every corner, coming down a staircase, coming from behind a cow barn.
And you're starting in one place, and this is proceeding toward...
So the entire journey goes from land to sea. It essentially traces James Deering's own journey from the agricultural heartland of the Midwest to the untamed seascapes of Miami in 1910. So we will be walking through the village, crossing Miami Avenue, South Miami Avenue, and traveling through the gardens to the sea.
How does this compare to, because it is tied into the first two shows, I should say, to Whirl and Bloom. But, what were those in comparison to what we're experiencing this time?
Well, one key difference is that each of those elements was about a particular part of the overall property. So Whirl was primarily in the gardens, and it was more of an immersive experience. We sort of let people wander wherever they might. There was no particular parade element to it. We sort of called it a puppet safari because people were just let loose in the gardens at night and they commingled with the various elements that were appearing. There was sort of a finale at the end, but essentially it was sort of almost like a free-for-all narrative environment that people could just explore to their heart's content. And Bloom was very similarly exploring the village and the different corners of the village, which was exciting for a lot of people because the village hasn't really been open to the public in quite the way that the gardens are. There have been events there, but they've been, specific events at a specific time and place.
Real quickly for you, who was James Deering? And for you, what does Vizcaya mean to you?
Well, one of the interesting things about this project is that Vizcaya was very interested in showing that the two properties are linked, that it really was one place that was, sort of welded together, the agricultural side and the sort of whimsical nautical fantasy that was part of the other side. And to me, that really is James Deering to a T. Here was this man who was extremely practical, very knowledgeable. He came out of helping to run International Harvester. He had made his millions in agricultural machinery. In all of his writings and diaries, he is a sort of micromanager of the estate. You know, things like drainage and what plant to grow where and how to deal with particular issues of the engineering of the barge. And I mean, he's very hands-on, very involved. And yet, there's this other side to him that was a wild seafaring romantic. You know, he would take off on his yacht, the Nepenthe, for days at a time. He created these playful secret grottos in the garden. So here was a man who really had these two sides. And for us, you know, Vizcaya is those two sides in a very sort of obvious geographical way. And the procession will sort of traverse from one side to the other.
I'm talking with Alex Kahn, co-founder and co-director of Processional Arts Workshops. This is the third year the group is teaming up with Vizcaya Museum Gardens for a theatrical performance. This year's performance is called Float, and it centers around the museum's relationship to the sea. How does Vizcaya's future tie into the dangers that we see, the risks that we see with sea level rise that Miami's facing right now?
That's a great question. And one of the things that we felt as site-specific artists that we had to address in this piece was that we are in a time where not only in Miami and at Vizcaya, but sort of around the world, there are huge challenges looming with rising sea levels, both in terms of the severity and frequency of storms that are, you know, hitting our coastlines, but also just the everyday slow inundation of our coasts. So Vizcaya is ground zero for that. The barge right now, they're doing a 3D digital scanning of the barge because they know that at some level, this is a structure that can't be saved. So we're going to plan B, in a sense, which is to say there will be concessions now to the rising tide. We don't know exactly what they will be. So for us, as we designed this adventure for people to go on, we definitely will have intimations of the contemporary mythology of the sea. It's not just some remote thing of there were, you know, storms and tempests and wild waves and sea creatures and all of that. It's not all in the age of exploration. Right now, today, as James Deering also faced, we face some serious challenges.
Let's finish with this. What did you hear from people after the first two performances? And did that in any way shape how you wanted to create this last one, Float?
Well, most of the feedback that we got from the first two performances was coming from the volunteers who had helped build them and who had helped animate them in performance. And the overwhelming impression I got from them was that it was the sense that people come into a workshop like this thinking they have no creative bones in their body. They're just looking to have an interesting experience. And you realize over the course of a week of making and a night of performing that creativity is hardwired into the human psyche. There is no such thing as an uncreative person. We may not all be oil painters on canvas, but we have creative approaches to every problem we face in everyday life. And so people felt, I think, empowered to be put in a position of being a masked performer. We veil all of our lantern performers, at least we did for the first two performances, so that they could be truly anonymous, truly become the element that they were carrying. And people felt that that was incredibly liberating, to just sort of step outside of yourself for a moment.
You will not be an observer.
Right.
Alex Kahn, the co-founder and co-director of Processional Arts Workshops. This is the third year this group teams up with Vizcaya Museum Gardens for a theatrical performance. And as Alex said, you will not be an observer. You will be part of this in one way or another. Alex, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure to be here.
And remember to check out Sundial's social media this weekend, as we will be sure to share photos and video from the float parade happening again on Saturday. And that's Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you again on Monday.